Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. He was a senior fellow at the United States Institute for Peace and held a Fulbright Research Fellowship for Afghanistan and Egypt. Marvin Weinbaum is an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directs the program in South Asian and Middle East Studies and has authored numerous books, including The Future of Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marvin Weinbaum.
Yes, hello, Gail.
And apparently the president did have a very sort of brief and cursory meeting with the Pakistani President Zardari today, at the close of the NATO summit, and clearly there's a lot of tension between the United States and Pakistan, and including NATO as well, by the way, about the closure of the supply routes to get equipment and supplies into Afghanistan in the NATO's long war there in Afghanistan. Do you think that there's any way that this could possibly be solved in an election year, where the Pakistanis are demanding an apology? And if the president were to apologize, that would be handing Mitt Romney a gift, because Mitt Romney's already gone public saying that Obama's foreign policy is to go and apologize to everyone.
Yeah, first of all, let me say that the gesture to Zardari, which wasn't anticipated, is largely because there's no reason to offend Zardari. Zardari has been, over the last 4 years, practically, the best person that we've had in enunciating our concerns in Pakistan. He doesn't carry very much weight there, but there's no reason to offend him. The larger question, though, is, as you rightly put it, can we, in this year, see some progress? I think ultimately we will. It's just taken an inordinately long time because it's caught up not on the issues themselves. It's not really that much about the price of each lorry which is going into Afghanistan, or the apology issue, or for that matter, even the drone issue. Because these are the kinds of issues that diplomats generally are able to negotiate on and come to a reasonable conclusion for both sides. Not everyone gets everything they want, naturally. But what is standing in the way is, of course, the fact that not just on our side are there political pressures, but there are clearly even stronger ones on the Pakistan side. The Islamists there and also the major opposition party have indicated that any resumption of the supply route is going to be met with a mass march across the country, and that they have made veiled threats that they're going to indeed try to disrupt that line of supply.
Well, that has happened on a number of occasions. Every time there's been a problem between the U.S. and Pakistan, the trucks have been attacked and the tankers have been blown up. It's not difficult to assume that there's some kind of tit-for-tat arrangement there with the Pakistani security forces, ISI, whatever, to arrange for the sabotage. Now you're saying these are political parties who are threatening to sabotage the supply route.
These are not just political, the jihadi groups in the country. They go under the name of the Defense of Pakistan Council, and they are a grouping of some of the most dangerous groups in Pakistan. And so if there is a sabotage of the supply lines, it's going to be far more serious. Before, what we did together with the Pakistan security forces is we bought off people. Yes, there were occasions when they were attacked, but everybody prospered to some extent from this. Criminal elements along the way, everybody got protection money. We're talking about something far more serious if, in fact, there is a resumption. That has to be factored into what's happening. Let me just say, in the larger context, the very breakdown of the relationship with Pakistan, the loss of faith between the two countries, the discovery that we really don't have that much in common when it comes to the future of the region. We do have some in common, and that's going to be the basis for any hope in of resuming a normal relationship. But there is so much that divides us here that it really stands in the way of our having the kind of trust that would lead both sides to be able to enter negotiations in good faith.
Again, I'm speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who was a former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003, and he's the author of The Future of Afghanistan. The Pakistani demands are a public apology for the killing of the 24 Pakistani soldiers following the cross-border incident between the U.S. and Pakistan, for which the U.S. has refused to apologize, and as we mentioned, this is an election year, and Obama simply can't hand Romney the gift of an apology because that's Romney's foreign policy campaign in terms of his television campaign. He's already been accusing Obama of apologizing to other countries. So that's a frozen issue. They wonder,
let me mention that we were on the verge of making what would have amounted to an apology several months ago. What happened was there then was an attack in Kabul, a very serious attack, and that was traced by most intelligence sources back to Pakistan and to this Haqqani group there, and that put a kibosh, really, on that overture to the Pakistanis. The president was prepared at that point to take some of the heat just in order to get things back on an even keel with Pakistan. But once that occurred, that really then, I think, torpedoed any kind of strictly speaking apology.
And the other issues under review are the U.S. policy on drone attacks inside Pakistan, and then a large increase in the current transit charges, which are currently $250 per vehicle of supplies coming in through Pakistan into Afghanistan. Apparently, the President Obama is unhappy about the fees that we already pay. And he's quite incensed by the price that the Pakistanis are trying to jack it up to. Is there any way that you can bribe them into submission, or has this become too hot a political potato inside Pakistan?
Again, I think that this is something that can be worked out if there's goodwill on both sides. They're asking for $5,000 against the current supposedly $250 that we're paying. Now, it's costing us more to keep the alternative going through the northern route, which goes through the Stans and Russia and out to Europe. So that it's not the money so much, but it's the idea that it's being held hostage. And that, too, could become a political issue that they have squeezed this out of us, and it's, again, not the dollar amount. It's more the idea of being blackmailed in this fashion by them. I do think, though, that they'll come to terms on this issue. The apology is a kind of zero-sum game. Either you do or you don't. That's going to be tougher unless they're willing to settle for something which is the most sincere of apologies, most sincere of regrets, rather. Sorry.
Sure. Well, but all of this makes, from what you've told us so far, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, is it makes one wonder who's in charge in Pakistan And of course, that's a perennial issue, isn't it? It's the old joke is that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And you've got these political parties now, Nawaz Sharif jockeying to take over. You've got a lame duck president who is widely detested and considered a completely incompetent. And as you mentioned earlier, at least President Obama didn't humiliate him today by having him join in the photo op and have a brief chat with him along with Karzai. But the long and short, he doesn't have any power. The popular sentiment there, from my understanding, is deeply anti-American.
Indeed, it is very anti-American. Let me say something interesting has occurred in this negotiation. Normally, this would be negotiations would be handled by the Pakistan military. What they did in this case was they pushed it on to the civilians and the parliament. And this was done as much as anything to have them be the heavies here and to make certain that those demands were going to be ones which they could then turn around and say, look, we can't back away because, you see, the country is demanding that we get the drones stopped, that we get an extraordinary price for allowing you to send those trucks through. So they've allowed them to take the heat here, and the political types who might ordinarily have said enough is enough, let's get on with it, are now feeling public opinion breathing down their back, and that's made this much more complicated. Whereas in the past, policy elites would simply get together and work out the details.
But of course, the United States does give a lot of aid to Pakistan, and even that aid itself, the Kerry bill, was it Kerry Lugar? Which was a substantial amount of money. That became a hot political issue, and the Pakistani media were talking about how the U.S. are trying to take over their country via Blackwater, and the money was. Was all to destabilize the country instead of try and build civilian institutions, which is what it was.
But you know, one of the demands that the Pakistanis have made is that yes, you're giving the civilian aid, the Kerry Lugar Berman bill, you're giving that, and but the truth is most of it never gets here, and most of it has not been spent. And with respect to the military assistance, one of the complaints that they have now is even though they're supposed to be getting something like $1.3 billion a year to carry on the fight against the extremists, we actually have not been passing that money on to them for some time now. And they claim that we're in arrears of up to $3 billion on that. We claim it's not quite that much. But here's another issue. We are holding that money back in this period because of our unhappiness with Pakistan's policy. So it's not as though they're getting everything and we're relenting on very much here. We have played hardball with them.
Well, yeah, but if this is a game of poker, we're playing hardball, but they're calling our bluff.
They are, but the military is hurting, even though that's a small part of their overall budget. Nevertheless, that amount of money is not the chicken feed, and it's money that they have come to depend on in their own military operations. So they do want to see a resumption of that. And also, we're talking here about military equipment, which we supply them with. So the military cannot allow this, I think, to go on indefinitely. At some point, they're going to, just as they did in the Davis affair, they pushed it.
Davis was a CIA guy. Worse. Davis was the CIA guy that was caught.
The CIA guy who shot up a couple of Pakistanis in February, I guess it was, last year.
Right.
And after having really provoked the public here into anger, then when it had gone too far, then they called off the dogs. Suddenly, a deal was arranged bringing the Saudis in, and money suddenly appeared to satisfy the families of the victims. So they do have that ability, but I think situation has changed enough in Pakistan these days where you can also say that the military has to some degree lost control over areas that it used to have a very tight command. And because in the past, anything having to do with foreign affairs or security issues was totally in the realm of the military. That's not quite as true today as it used to be.
Again, I'm speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003, and he's the author of The Future of Afghanistan. So you mentioned, the supply routes they've jacked up the Pakistanis. The increase is, previously we were being charged $250 per vehicle, and now they've jacked it up to $5,000 per vehicle. There's a huge backlog, and we're having to fly a lot of stuff in, which is very expensive. And as you say, the northern route through Russia and the stands is even more expensive. So this opens up the question, though, of now that the NATO summit, the statement from the NATO summit is a definite date that they are going to withdraw. That was the one piece of news that came out of it that was quite unanimous, that we're getting the hell out of there. Now, how are they going to get all that heavy equipment out?
Well, this will be a concern. We do have time yet. We'd be looking at that next year, and certainly in 2014 will become a serious matter. We will, by that point, I think we will have settled this. The larger issue here is getting out. Yet what that means here is, first of all, we'll see that the NATO forces, and that includes the United States, of course, will no longer take the lead in military operations and combat operations after next summer. That's been pretty well established now. And something which was agreed on in Lisbon in 2010 has been reaffirmed by this conference that took place in Chicago today, and that is that the military operations entirely of NATO will end by the December of 2014. What has been added to that now is the strategic agreement, which is signed between the United States and the Afghans, which, if once the details are laid out, could have the U.S. leaving behind a residual force of 15, 20, 25,000 troops, not for combat, but for training. At the same time, let me say that they'll be there able to defend themselves if they have to, but they would not be involved in combat. That can work in that kind of capacity, but only if the Afghan military remains loyal to the government and competent enough to stave off attacks by the Taliban. That's a big if now. We're not at all confident about that. If they can, then that force can play a very important role because it can tell the Taliban don't wait around for to take over this place. We're going to be here. We're going to be here with economic assistance, development assistance, as well as we're going to have troops on the ground. So you just don't count on simply taking over this country after 2014.
But just in closing, the Taliban could reply to that, well, we've got Pakistan on our side, and they're going to really determine the future. And just on the other issue of the Afghan army, nobody said anything particularly optimistic about the state of that army. And my understanding is that one third of NATO casualties have come from friendly fire from people that we've been training have turned their guns on us.
Well, that one third is true, but that suggests that, unfortunately, our casualties over the last several months have been very low. So, yes, what has happened in the way of a friendly fire, as you call it, has been a large proportion of that. About Pakistan, I think we have to recognize that Pakistan is not anxious to see the Taliban score a complete victory in Afghanistan. It for all that it uses the Afghan Taliban, it is fearful that if they were to return and monopolized power, consolidated power in the country, what would then happen is that they would very likely then turn back on Pakistan in support of the Pakistani Taliban, a group which did not exist in the 1990s. So they really would prefer to see in Afghanistan not a Taliban victory, but a political solution. That's their optimal policy, and they've been working for that. The trouble is that they can't get the Afghan Taliban to accept terms that aren't really ones that effectively turn the country back over to them. We're a little clearer on that. What they can't get the Afghans to agree to the kind of compromise that would lead them into a coalition government, into a power-sharing arrangement with those who now are in power in the country. And their failure to do that means, at the moment, Pakistan is kind of caught. It doesn't have really a good solution.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. He was a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace and held Fulbright Research Fellowships for Afghanistan and Egypt, and is an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directs the program in South Asian and Middle East Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the son of a CIA spymaster who spilled the family jewels.